in America, I think it's rads still. I think they still use rads.
That's right,
rems,
yeah.
So it's millirems. But anyway, just to compare it, the dose from an alpha particle is 500 millisieverts, and the annual dose limit from the government to the whole body is 1 millisievert. You know, so the point is your cell gets a lot more than the annual dose limit just from one decay.
I get you. And I'm curious as to gamma radiation that the ICRP, their safety standards have been based on the gamma radiation dose, you're saying, all these years?
Yes, they are. They have been. I mean, they obviously had to deal with internal radiation, but what they do there is they just take the energy from the internal decay, from the alpha or from the beta, and they just dissolve it into the whole body. And this is a very important point, which I'm going to sort of say once, but then if you don't understand it, but I'd better repeat it or in a different way, because this is the key error in the ICRP risk model, and the one that has resulted in many, many inquiries that have concluded that increases in cancer in downwinders or in people living near nuclear plants or people after Chernobyl, or, you know, enormous numbers of cases where people have been shown, like uranium is a good example, you know, from Iraq, shown to be ill after exposure to these internal radionuclides. The inquiry has always found that the dose is too low. So we need to understand what is meant by dose. And I think I said earlier that what the ICRP does is it models the body as a bag of water. Now, that's okay if you imagine a bag of water standing outside at Hiroshima and a big flash bulb goes off, poof. You know, every bit of that bag of water, and if it's a human being, every cell in the body will get roughly the same amount of energy, you know, because it's light and it just travels out radially from its source. So averaging it is reasonable. I mean, and physicists made a reasonable assumption when they averaged it as energy per unit mass. But now let's take a piece of plutonium or a little piece of radioactive material and stick it inside that bag of water, say in the top left-hand corner, and just leave it there for a few years. Now, this little plutonium particle or uranium particle will kick off lots and lots of these alpha particles as it decays. I'm not talking about an atom now. I'm talking about an actual particle, about 1 micron across, like they have floating about in Iraq. Now, under those circumstances, a little part of that phantom, of that bag of water, will receive an enormous dose, absolutely enormous dose. But what the ICRP will do is take all of that energy from that dose and again dissolve it into the entire body. Now, that, of course, is the source of the error, because cancer starts in a single cell or in a small area of the body, in a small community of cells. It doesn't start in the whole body at once. Now, an example would be, for instance, and this is quite an accurate example, would be if I were to sit in front of a fire and to warm myself, I would get a dose there. It's exactly the same as a radiation dose, because the radiation from the fire is infrared radiation. It warms me up. And I would get a dose of so many joules per kilogram. I could measure the number of joules, and I know what I weigh in kilograms, so I just divide one by the other. And it would give me a certain dose. But that would keep me quite warm and pleasant, you know, as I watched the television. But on the other hand, I could reach into the fire and pick out a red-hot coal and eat it. Now, the thing is, that would give me the same dose, you see. But it would kill me. I know it sounds absurd, but that is actually what they do.
Even though
the concept of dose is misapplied, it's an inadmissible use of scientific method.
I see.
It's what's called deduction rather than induction.
Can you explain that, induction and deduction?
Well, it was developed originally by William of Ockham in the 12th century. This is the scientific method, extremely powerful. And the scientific method basically involves induction. It's called scientific induction. And what it says is that what there is in common to different instances of a happening or of an event is the cause of or is related to the cause of that event. Okay, that's induction. So if we see, you know, nuclear sites in Europe and nuclear sites in England, nuclear sites in Germany, nuclear sites in Sweden, in France, and we see childhood leukemia near those nuclear sites, then the method of induction demands that we assume that the nuclear site is the cause of or related to the cause of the effect. Now, deduction, what that does is it uses a model based on some other theory. So you start with a theory with deduction, and you carry it forward and you explain something on the basis of theory. And in terms of science, that is just a secondary method of doing things.
Hmm.
It's not acceptable philosophically. And I've said this in many arenas, but of course, you know, the scientists are not philosophers, although they ought to be.
Well, yeah, science, I think, grew out of philosophy originally. But that's very...
Yes,
that's
of course it did. I mean, it used to be called natural philosophy, and in fact, the Royal Society, to whom I gave evidence in the case of uranium... Yeah, here we are. This is John Stuart Mill. This is from the European Committee on Radiation Risk report, which I wrote or I edited in 2003. The classical exposition of the scientific or inductive method is what called Mill's canon. So the first one states that whatever there is in common between the antecedent conditions of a phenomenon can be supposed to be the cause or related to the cause of the phenomenon. And then there's a canon of difference, which states that the difference in the conditions under which an effect occurs and those under which it does not must be the cause or related to the cause of the effect. And then there are various other little things that you add on. But what you certainly cannot do is say, look, because the tiny doses that they got at these nuclear sites couldn't have caused leukemia in Japanese survivors of an atomic bomb, it couldn't possibly have caused leukemia in the children. But, it's just completely different scientific approach. One is chronic exposure to internal radioactive substances, which never existed on Earth prior to 1945, and the other is people put out in the open and exposed to an enormous giant flash bulb. If it weren't for political and military pressure to develop bombs and to keep the world safe from the Red Peril and all the rest of that, you know, this would have been rumbled long ago.
Mm-hmm.
The people who would have rumbled it are the World Health Organization, and they were effectively gagged in 1959 when they were forced into an agreement with the other United Nations body called the International Atomic Energy Agency.
I see.
So in 1959, WHO signed an agreement with IAEA in which all of the research onto radiation and health was left in the hands of IAEA, and their remit is the peaceful development of nuclear power. This is a conflict of interest.
I get you. We're talking to Dr. Christopher Busby, who's a British scientist known for his work on the health effects of ionizing radiation. And we're discussing basically his current work on setting new standards for health effects of exposure to low doses of ionizing radiation and some of the history leading up to this new document that I think you're about to release. Is that right?
Yes, yes. We've released one of the chapters of it on uranium. Is already we put that one on the internet for free, but the actual book itself is at the printers at the moment, and it should be released. Hoping it will be released, it will be printed in time for April the 26th.
So it sounds like you're saying that the major mistake that's been made by these other regulatory agencies in setting standards for radiation doses is that they've been using models. Mathematical models instead of actually looking at the reality.
Yes, absolutely.
Of the situation.
In fact, I think, to be honest, having studied this, for me, the philosophy of this is actually more interesting than the science. The science is quite straightforward, really, but the philosophy is not straightforward because you have to ask yourself why it is that scientists, you know, people presumably intelligent, persist in this notion that they can apply these external risk models to internal risk. I'm really at a loss to understand how it works. I know from my own experience that there's an awful lot of pressure put on scientists, but you would think more people would break. I mean, a number of them have. I mean, Ed Radford in America resigned from the ICRP on a similar sort of issue. And who else? John Goffman, he got kicked out by the
Atomic Energy Commission.
And there are a few heroes, but precious few. It's almost like scientists are sheep, you know, and they just want to be part of the gang rather than actually think for themselves.
Well, and let's talk about the politics of the science of studying
yeah,
the radiation
sure.
industry. What does happen when you break ranks with the status quo in a scientific situation?
Well, I mean, it's like Gandhi said. First they laugh at you, then they attack you, then you win. It is kind of like that. I mean, when I first started, they just laughed at me. They said, "Who are you? Some banjo player from the mountains?" Then I just persisted, you know. And I eventually got my stuff into the media by just cleverness, by chaining myself up to nuclear power stations and writing little books and pamphlets. I taught myself to print and bought a second-hand printing press which needed doing up, and I taught myself to make it. And it's quite hard. This is litho printing.
Yeah.
And so I did all of this stuff, you know, and produced leaflets and went around the place talking and spreading the message. And of course, because I'm basically right, because it's so blindingly obvious, you know, that I'm right, and not because of anything to do with how great I can, you know, my great performance or any of that stuff. I think that I eventually, by about 1996, when I wrote the first book, I persuaded a big Quaker charity to fund me for 6 months or a year to write a book called Wings of Death, which lays out what I'd found at that time. And this was an extraordinarily influential book, and it got me invited all over the place and attacked violently by, you know, the nuclear industry and all their buddies.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of it was quite plausible, and certainly the epidemiology was interesting, you know, people tended to believe it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the main epidemiological finding that I presented in that book was a comparison of the cancer rates in Wales and England. Now England and Wales have very good cancer registries, which go right back. And so the data is quite easily available, and you can look at cancer rates in England and Wales. But the interesting thing is that because Wales is much wetter, where I live here, it's much rainier, there's a lot more strontium-90. There's a lot more weapons fallout. And all this stuff was measured by the British Agricultural Research Laboratory, so that data is available as well. So it's really quite a simple but rather tedious process to put all this stuff together and to show that there's a very powerful correlation between the increase in cancer in Wales, because what happened after the weapons fallout, cancer increased in Wales, but not in England, you see, and then it started to increase in England later on. So you could relate these two to the weapons fallout, and you came out with a factor of 300 being the error factor in the risk model of the ICRP. And so I presented that in 1995. Of course, everybody screamed and yelled. And then I started the low-level radiation campaign with a colleague and a girlfriend. And that was very successful. We produced a journal, Radioactive Times. Incidentally, we did this all on very little money, you know. Nobody gave us any money. Edward Goldsmith gave us a little bit of money. And Sir James Goldsmith gave us a new printing press, really nice one, which I've still got, actually. And so we printed our way through various campaigns. And then the Irish government, I went over to Ireland to talk about Sellafield. We have a reprocessing plant here on the Irish Sea, which dumps all its radiation into the Irish Sea. And there was a court case being brought by some people in Ireland against England, because Ireland doesn't have any nuclear power, you know. So it was concerned that it might be receiving effects from Sellafield. So I got a job working as a project, which I set up to look at health effects of people living near the Irish Sea, and I found that people living near the Irish Sea had about a 40% increase risk of cancer if they lived within 800 meters of the sea, and we found that we could explain that on the basis of measurements that were made of plutonium that was brought ashore by sea spray. And incidentally, this effect also occurs in America, because I've done some work on data that Joe Mangano gave me on Millstone, the Millstone reactor in New England. Where is it? Connecticut. And that shows the same sort of effect. You know, you get high levels of leukemia near the coast because of this exposure to salt spray containing the radioactive substances which get dumped into the sea, and Millstone is a really dirty reactor. It dumps all this stuff into the sea.
So you're saying that that spray produces something that you actually ingest?
Yeah, you inhale it. You don't ingest it. No.
Oh, I see.
Ingestion isn't too bad, incidentally. What we've discovered is that the transfer coefficients for these substances from ingestion are not very great. It's inhalation that's the problem. They go up the nose and into the lung and then straight through into the lymphatic system and then into the bloodstream, just like that. The reason we know this is because there have been measurements made in this country of people living near the sea. So, you know, this is not just like some crazy theory. We measured the plutonium near the sea, and then there were measurements made that were published of the autopsies, you know, the corpses. So people who died, they got, I think, 400 or 500 people, and they cut them up and looked inside their chests and found the plutonium. So you've got much more plutonium if you live near the sea than if you live inland.
And that's only if you live near a reprocessing plant? Is that a recycling, nuclear recycling?
It's a reprocessing plant.
I see. Sure. So that's what they're trying to sell here in the United States now. The nuclear power industry is in a big push to sell us new reactors, and recycling is the panacea they're selling to.
I don't understand recycling. I mean, you mean reprocessing? So you're going to take the plutonium and burn it in mixed oxide fuel? Is that the thing?
I think so. And somehow they're going to get new fuel out of it.
I mean, that's possible. But the point is that all it does is it deals with a little bit of the plutonium. It doesn't deal with all the other crap, you know. I mean, there's just enormous amounts of this stuff that comes out. Plutonium is just one of the isotopes. You've got americium, you've got neptunium, you've got strontium, you've got tritium, you've got carbon-14, you've got a whole witch's brew of cobalt-60, you've got an enormous lot of stuff that comes out, and there's nowhere to put it, you know, and a lot of it's gaseous, you know, so you can't stop it coming out. Strontium-90, for instance, starts life as a gas.
I see.
So you can't filter it, you can't keep the strontium-90 in. It comes out as a gas and instantly turns into strontium-90 and then floats about. So people inhale it, it gets into the milk, and they drink the milk, it gets into their bones and into the DNA. And that's another thing we found as the ECRR. So this new report that's coming out, you know, we found that there was about this 300-fold error. The question is, why is it that number? There's been a big study recently in Germany of children living near nuclear plants, you know, and that shows an increase in leukemia. Be interpreted on the basis of an error factor of about 1,000. And I published a paper recently in the Journal of Environmental and Public Health in which I looked at children who were born after the Chernobyl accident in Europe, who had been in the womb at the time of the fallout, you know, the Chernobyl fallout.
Yeah.
So this is a very precise group of children. This is a cohort, we call them, that is chosen exactly because they were only in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl fallout. And they show an increase in infant leukemia. And the error factor there is 600. So, you know, wherever we go and we look at these numbers, we find this error factor of between 300 and 1,000. So that does seem to be approximately the error. Oh, yeah, there's another one. Martin Tondell, a scientist in, young man he is, in northern Sweden. I think he was at Linköping, or maybe Uppsala, anyway. He did a study of cancer in the small areas of northern Sweden after Chernobyl. That was published in 2004, and that showed quite strongly, highly significantly, an 11% increase in cancer per 100 kilobecquerels per square meter of cesium-137 contamination. And it's easy to show that level of contamination produces a dose which results in an error factor of the ICRP model of about 650. So you see that everywhere you look, you get this error factor for internal radiation exposures. And this is like, in my opinion, this is the public health scandal of human history.
So you're talking about these two models, the old model that everybody's been using being that inaccurate by that factor, 600 to 1,000.
Correct. And that's enabled the continuous contamination since 1945.
Yeah, what's the significance of these models and the fact that the standards are just so far off? What's the
significance? That is the significance. The significance is that the model that they use at the moment is wildly inaccurate for exposure to internal radionuclides. So, in other words, any operation of a nuclear power station or any releases of internal radionuclides from the stacks of a reprocessing plant or from the boilers of a nuclear submarine or whatever, the extent to which that then gets absorbed by human beings or by fish or by animal life or whatever, plant life, is going to cause the destruction, you know, of that plant life or animal life or human life by a factor which is much, much larger than is currently believed. So in other words, the simplest way of looking at it is that the present limits should only apply to external radiation, you know, so that they're fine for X-rays and things like that. But for internal radiation, they should be dropped by a factor of 600. Hmm. And probably different for different radiations if one wanted to get nitpicky about it.
Yeah. And the significance of that,
The significance of that is the end of the nuclear industry. Or else, and in fact, I mean, you know, people say, are you anti-nuclear? And I always say, well, you know, if we're talking about democracy here, and I mean, I'm not sure myself about democracy, although I'm a Green Party speaker. If we're talking about democracy, then democracy depends upon people knowing the truth, you know. You have to have perfect knowledge for democracy. Now, in the 19th century, when democracy was set up, you know, by and large, politicians knew the score. So if there was some policy being mooted, you know, do this or do that, the politicians themselves would have a good understanding of what was going on, you know, and they could make a choice, or human beings, you know, working for them, or the public, or whatever. But nowadays, that's no longer true. We have to depend upon these arcane mathematical, you know, arm wavings that we see coming from the International Commission on Radiological Protection, and it's just wrong. People are dying because of this. And in fact, last year, I met with the ICRP. Scientific Secretary Jack Valentin in Stockholm. We had a public debate. He just resigned then, because the pressures on the ICRP is now getting so great that it's becoming embarrassing. You know, evidence is coming out from all over the place that this model is completely wacko. So you've got evidence from Chernobyl. I mean, Alexei Yablokov has just written an enormously fat book, which was published by the New York Academy of Sciences, on the real effects of Chernobyl. And there's effects coming out in uranium weapons, uranium areas, where, like Fallujah, where you've got all these birth deformities and so on. So the ICRP are under vast pressure. And the ICRP risk model guy, you know, the man who was like the chief wizard, if you like, since 1988, was a Swedish guy called Jack Valentin. And he resigned this last year, 2009. And he met with me in Stockholm, and he said two very important things. And this is all on video. We're going to stick it on YouTube, incidentally. I just haven't got around to it because I'm so busy. But he said, firstly, that the ICRP risk model cannot be used to predict the effects of exposure of human populations. I mean, quite clearly he said that. And I said, well, what's it for then? He said, oh, well, you know, it's just to get a rough idea. And I said, well, why can't it be used? Because frankly, you know, I mean, if I was a politician, I'd be quite concerned by about what you said. And he said, oh, well, you know, because there are very large uncertainties. And I said, well, what level of uncertainty? He said, oh, well, maybe two orders of magnitude. Well, that's where they're home and dry, aren't we? 500, two orders of magnitude. And this is the man himself. If you look at the ICRP 2007 model, there he is. I mean, you know, it says ICRP 2007, Health Effects of Low-Dose Radiation, Jack Valentin. And then also the other one, the one that came before it, was the 1990 ICRP 60, also edited by Jack Valentin. And also you might wonder how all this manages to stay together, you know. What's the kind of glue that holds all this stuff together, this crap? And the truth is that there are actually not that many people involved. If you take the Bayer reports, and I mean, if you take the main committees that look at this stuff, there's the Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation Committee of the National Academy of Sciences, one.
Yeah.
Then you get the NCRP, then you get the ICRP, and then you've got the NRPB in England, National Radiological Protection Board, now called the HPA. They keep changing their names. Then the International Atomic Energy Agency. And if you look at the personnel on these committees, they're all the same people. It's extraordinary. And in fact, I put a whole page of that in the ECRR report that's coming out. Because what happens is that if governments go to the ICRP or to NRPB or HPA or whatever, and they say, how do you know that you're right? Because this guy Busby says, you know, that you might be wrong. They say, oh, well, we consult with the ICRP. But they are the ICRP. Or they say, oh, we consult with the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. But if you look in UNSCA, you find they're all the same people. So they don't have very far to go to consult with these people, because they just have to pick up the phone and talk to themselves.
So you're saying it's basically a small club.
Rosalie Bertel was one of the first people to point that out. It's a self-selected club of people who work for the nuclear industry, and its job, you know, like all political jobs, is to maintain the status quo. And the argument, the political argument, is that we need this stuff. So who cares if a few people die, because we need the bombs. I mean, that's essentially it. You know, it's a kind of military operation. It's a bit like the use of uranium. You know, everyone's squealing about the use of uranium. And what they ought to say is, look, we used uranium because we wanted to defeat Saddam Hussein, you know, and we don't really care if everybody dies in Iraq, because we don't care about the Iraqis. You know, who are they to us? So that's what they really think, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But of course, they'd never dare say that, because nowadays, you know, it's all PC. You have to But in the Second World War, you know, they wouldn't have had two thoughts about it. You know, this is the military. That's what they do.
So you, this is probably the subject for an entire other show. I'd like to stick to more to more general issues here about radiation and the history of its use.
In any way, just ask.
But depleted uranium you're referring to in Iraq, they use there, and we were told over here at the time that, of course, there's no health effects from depleted uranium. I heard that from my congressperson, and I heard that from some health professionals, too.
Well, what they do is they apply the risk model of the ICRP. I mean, nobody actually looks at the data. They just look at the doses. They say that uranium is very weakly radioactive, ordinary uranium, and depleted uranium is 40% less radioactive, so it must be less harmful than ordinary uranium. And that's the kind of the level of the argument. I mean, I saw a letter to the paper recently where some bloke wrote that. The problem is that they actually use rather a lot of it. That's the point. So although it might be 40% less radioactive than ordinary uranium, they dropped 350 tons on Iraq in 1991. And measured as actual total radioactivity, now, by that I mean number of disintegrations per second, that amount of uranium is equivalent to about 2 kilograms of plutonium, which is much more radioactive. Now, if they'd have dropped 2 kilograms of plutonium on Iraq, you know, they'd have all been sent off to Nuremberg. So you have to be a little bit careful about the science here. Now, there's another point about uranium, which is actually my own discovery, because I've been researching uranium since 1996, I think. Yeah, that's right. I was one of the first people to suggest that Gulf War syndrome was caused by uranium. I went out to Iraq in 2001 and measured uranium on the battlefield there, and also I went to Kosovo, where NATO forces had fought and used uranium. So I've been looking at this uranium business for some time. I gave evidence to the Royal Society in 2001, and then I was a member of the British Uranium Depleted Uranium Oversight Board, and I was joint author of their final report. Uranium has a very curious property, which ought to have been noticed, but wasn't, which is that it has a very high atomic number. Now, you know that, that if you look at a periodic table, if you look at all the elements on Earth, you get little small elements like hydrogen, and then they go up to bigger elements, you know, lithium and beryllium and boron and metal elements, lead and so on. The element with the highest atomic number, that's the most electrons, on the bottom right-hand corner of the periodic table is uranium, 92 electrons it's got. Now, it does turn out, and this is just standard physics that's been known for many, many years, you know, since the 19th century. Is that right? No, maybe the 20th century. And anyway, certainly known throughout the 20th century, that elements absorb gamma radiation and X radiation in proportion to the fourth power of their atomic number. So in other words, hydrogen, if you beam some gamma radiation at water, we can model water as oxygen, which has got an atomic number of 8. So if you take the relative absorption of water, and we'll assume that we're made of water, you can say it's like 8 times 8 times 8 times 8, you know, whatever that is. But if you get uranium, the absorption of uranium inside you is 92 times 92 times 92 times 92, which is like a very large number. And I can tell you that sum gives you an increased absorption of gamma radiation by the uranium inside you of a factor of about 250,000. You know, so in other words, if you've got uranium inside you, that uranium, it acts as a sort of antenna for natural background radiation. And we're all exposed to natural background radiation. So in other words, the uranium doesn't even have to be radioactive, you know. It just relies entirely upon its high atomic number. Now, that in itself wouldn't necessarily be a problem, except that uranium has an enormous affinity for DNA. And this was discovered in the 60s when they started to look for elements that would bind to DNA in order to do electron microscopy. And they discovered that the affinity constant for DNA was very large. And an American called Nielsen in 1992 found that the affinity constant was about 10 to the 10, which is very big. What it means is that quite modest contamination with uranium, even the sort of uranium contamination that you might find normally in nature, you would get uranium binding to the DNA. And so when you then look through the literature to follow that up, you find, lo and behold, people who are living in areas of high levels of uranium, and the uranium miners, and anyone who's exposed to uranium, has a very high level of chromosome damage. So in other words, something is cutting their DNA into pieces. So uranium is actually probably one of the most dangerous elements that there are. And it's not particularly about its low level of radioactivity. It's about the fact that it does this phantom, what's called secondary photoelectron effect. Because when it absorbs this gamma ray, it shoots off a photoelectron. And if it's a particle, you know, and most of these weaponized uranium exposures are due to little particles of about 1 micron or less, maybe 100 nanometers. Actually, I think the mean diameter is about 0.8 of a micron. So it just floats into your nose, floats up into your brain, incidentally. They've done experiments on that in France with rats inhaling uranium particles, and it goes straight into the center of the brain, into the hippocampus.
That's a nanoparticle.
Yeah, well, they're not quite nanoparticles. They're larger than that.
Oh.
They're sort of like intermediate between microparticles and nanoparticles.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if there probably are nanoparticles as well, but anyway, certainly the experiments that have been done at the Aberdeen Proving Ground where they've measured this stuff, the mean aerodynamic diameter of these particles is about 800 nanometers. And my colleagues who do the nanoparticle stuff at the University of Ulster, they wouldn't really class that as a nanoparticle. They like to think a nanoparticle is like 10 nanometers or maximum 50 nanometers, you know.
Okay.
So, but anyway, the point is that these things then act as secondary sources for photoelectrons, and they then act like these little... like little hot sparks, you know, again.
Mm-hmm.
But they're there all the time. So as long as they don't have to, it's not a question of them being radioactive. It's just that so long as they're in the body, they're sucking in the gamma radiation from the natural background and re-emitting it into the DNA as photoelectrons. Now, if that DNA happens to be DNA in the hippocampus, then it just deranges you. So you get all of these effects that the Gulf War syndrome people were complaining about. You know, all these kind of strange housekeeping effects like giddiness and loss of memory and sweating attacks and diarrhea and bowel problems, incontinence. You know, all this weird stuff, which everybody said must be due to stress.
Dr. Busby, we only have about 2 minutes left.
And okay, sorry, I've been guessing on it.
No, it's very interesting, and I'd like to spend some more time at some point when you're not whizzing about. But I'd like to, you just said the Gulf War syndrome was caused by depleted uranium, possibly. It sounds like you're saying radiation, we always think of it as causing cancer, but you're saying there's many illnesses that can be caused by radiation before you actually have cancer?
Absolutely. It causes every kind of illness. The process through which it does this is called genomic instability, and it's now well known, and this is seen in the survivors of the Chernobyl disaster, and it's seen in survivors of the Hiroshima bombing. You get just about every disease it's possible to get is associated with exposure to ionizing radiation, because basically it's just damaging DNA, and it's DNA that regulates your body. So if you smash up the DNA, you know, everything's going to go wonky.
So with 1 minute to go, Dr. Christopher Busby, a British scientist working on ionizing radiation, you sounded fairly optimistic about the prospects for getting these new standards in place. And why is that?
Well, I'm by nature an optimist, but I'm optimistic because I see the evidence as slowly building up. I mean, there are some things that you just cannot keep quiet, you know. I mean, and the evidence is just so enormous that to continue to sustain this outdated and ridiculous model in the face of the huge amount of evidence from all over the place that it's just plainly wrong is just impossible, in my opinion.
I see. So even...
And so I think it will have to fail at some point.
Hmm. So even with the political pressure to maintain the status quo and the nuclear industry and the military complex...
Well, we do have a democratic procedure. I mean, and so we can take the war to Washington. I mean, the veterans in America have managed to swing it so that there's a reopening of the question of the origin of Gulf War syndrome, and I sent off evidence to that. And I'm prepared to go along there and show, you know, give examples of all the things that I've said to you.
That's...
And if there's any honesty in the world, and of course, you know, I am an optimist, I have to say, if there is any honesty in the world, and I think there are honest people in the world, I think that eventually we will prevail.
Now, continuing in the same optimistic vein, this is a compilation by Mara Galadin from 10 years of TUC radio about shutting down nuclear power stations. I trimmed a bit off the end that was talking about hydrogen fuel cells. If you'd like to hear the original and a lot more good stuff besides, you can go to tucradio.org.
It was and is possible to stop nuclear power plants. From TUC Radio's archive, here are 10 examples of closed plants and as many good reasons why. The proponents of nuclear power now claim that nuclear power plants need to be brought back in order to prevent global warming. the Nuclear Information Resource Service, responded to that claim by stating, "Nuclear power is not emission-free. From uranium mining, milling, and enrichment to construction and waste storage, nuclear uses fossil fuels. Nuclear power plants are also cost prohibitive. One reactor takes 7 to 10 years to build. Reactors cost $4 billion or more each a decade ago, and the price hasn't gone down. Devoting scarce resources to shore up nuclear takes away from the real climate change solutions, conservation, energy efficiency, and renewables like wind and solar." K-Dry has worked on hazards from so-called routine releases of radioactive gases and waste from nuclear power plants. In 1976, she chaired a statewide campaign in Missouri that resulted in the cancellation of a nuclear reactor already under construction. Here is Kay Dry.
In the 30 years since my first public speech on nuclear power, that is, against nuclear power, I've asked many questions, read many documents, and have consulted with many experts in the field. The result has been an even greater bias against nuclear power. My favorite reason for disliking nuclear power is that workers are exposed to radiation at facilities throughout the uranium fuel cycle, from mining through the handling of the waste. My second favorite reason is what brings me here today, the fact that every nuclear facility releases radioactive waste to the environment as a part of its routine operation. It does not take an accident. I remember when I first learned about routine releases. I was walking toward a public meeting at the Callaway Nuclear Plant, under construction at the time in Missouri, alongside a farmer from Kansas who was fighting the proposed Wolf Creek plant near his farm. He told me there would be a vent in the reactor building and that radioactive gases would be released to the atmosphere through the vent. I had known that the walls, roof, and foundation of the reactor building were to be built of thick concrete, reinforced with steel bars, and assumed that they were designed to completely seal the radioactivity inside. However, I found out the farmer was right. The reactor building does have a vent. I had often read that a core meltdown plus a break in the containment building would let radioactive gas into the atmosphere. What I had not known is that the building comes with a break in it. That is, a vent for the release of gases, including radioactive gases. In fact, nuclear power plants cannot operate without regular, deliberate releases of radioactive water and gases. The releases from the reactor building are needed to control the pressure, temperature, and humidity, and to keep radioactivity from exceeding government limits for workers. The vents have filters that stop some of the radioactive gases from being released. However, no filtering technology exists for some gases, like xenon-135, which decays into cesium-135, an isotope with a 2-million-year half-life. Certain gaseous and liquid wastes leak or are intentionally removed from the reactor vessel or the steam generators or the irradiated fuel pool during a plant's routine operation. When these waste products are present in concentrations below the alarm set point of the radioactive waste system, the waste can be released to the river or other cooling water source without detection and therefore without reporting. So no one really knows how much is released. Noble gases, tritium, and other fission and activation products can be released to the atmosphere. Tritiated water, dissolved or entrained noble gases and other wastes can also be released to the river. I remember being amused when I learned that certain fission gases, like xenon and krypton, are called noble gases because they don't mingle with or form compounds with the hoi polloi. Therefore, while radioactive gases accidentally or intentionally released to the atmosphere from a plant building are routed through high-efficiency particulate absolute, or HEPA, filters before being discharged to the ventilation stacks, noble gases can just pass right through the filters. Tritium, or radioactive hydrogen, can, too. event is located not only in the domed roof of the reactor containment building, but also in the auxiliary building, the radioactive waste building, and the turbine building. The plant's routine operation includes two types of planned gaseous releases, both venting and purging. To vent a building, a valve is merely opened. To purge a building, a fan is used. In addition to the typical containment building unit vent that may be operated an average of 2 to 4 times a year, newer nuclear power plants have small diameter purge lines, about 8 inches in diameter or less, that can provide a continuous purge while the reactor is at power. To return to chemically inert noble gases, while it is correct that noble gases may not readily interact chemically with other materials, they can physically interact. If inhaled or swallowed, noble gases can cause physical harm while passing through the body or if entrapped within it. They give off physical energy as radiation in the form of particles and rays. The radiation is able to penetrate body tissues. The physical energy of the radioactive particle can change the structure of DNA, just as when a car that is standing still is hit by a car in motion. If the particle mutates a gene that produces an enzyme that is not particularly vital to the cell's machinery, the damage may not even be noticeable. On the other hand, if it mutates a gene important to cell function, very serious manifestations can occur, particularly cancer and other life-shortening diseases, including circulatory, respiratory, muscular, reproductive, and immune system disorders. In addition to the many shorter-lived radioactive gases generated at nuclear power plants, one that is of particular environmental concern and that is produced in high yield in nuclear power reactors and weapons is krypton-85. It has a radioactive half-life of 10.77 years. The krypton-85 that is generated in a reactor today will continue releasing beta particles for at least 10 half-lives or more than 100 years. As with the plant's gases, not all radioactive isotopes can be filtered from the water. No economically feasible technology exists to do so. Tritium or radioactive hydrogen, for example, cannot be filtered. A great deal of tritium accumulates in a nuclear reactor, both as a fission product that leaks out from the fuel and by the absorption of neutrons by the boron additive in the cooling water. Just as water containing ordinary hydrogen and oxygen is a component of all living cells, tritiated water, a major byproduct of nuclear power plant operation, can also be incorporated into all the cells of the body. Many laboratory studies have shown that long-term chronic exposure to even low concentrations of tritium is more damaging than previously believed. Some of the hazards resulting from tritium uptake include mutations, tumors, and cell death. Other radioactive isotopes are also released to the environment without being filtered when they are at a concentration below the level the plant monitors are set to detect, a level the government has decreed to be acceptable. But acceptable does not mean safe. It means as low as reasonably achievable. In other words, as low as the industry claims it can afford to achieve. Radioactive wastes are produced by the fissioning of the uranium and by the neutron activation of corrosion products or rust in the reactor coolant system. I'd like to mention the first technical word I learned when I started my study of nuclear power. It was crud, the name given to the corrosion products in the primary cooling system. It was created as an acronym for Chalk River Unidentified Deposits, referring to the extremely radioactively hot and dangerous rust that was first found at the Chalk River plant in Canada following an accident. The corrosion products in a reactor become radioactive when they are bombarded by neutrons. They accumulate on the piping, fuel rods, valves, steam generator tubes, and even on the walls of the reactor vessel itself. Some of the activation products that slough off into the cooling water escape past the particulate filters and end up being released to the environment. The rust that builds up in the steam generators, that is, in the secondary cooling system, are not called crud. They're called the green grunge. These corrosion products, it's very hard to find humor in this field, you know. These corrosion products also clog up essential cooling equipment and give off highly penetrating gamma rays that place welders and other workers at great risk during the repair and replacement of leaking components. To give a sense of how much radiation is emitted, one repair of corroded components at Indian Point 1, about 25 miles from Times Square in New York, took 8 months and required 700 men in order to stay within the radiation exposure regulations. A similar repair effort in a conventional power plant would have taken about 2 weeks, not 8 months, using 25 men, not 700 men. In order to try to reduce the radiation fields in which workers must repair defective equipment and to make the reactor operate more efficiently, solvents are often used, including chelating agents that dissolve the highly radioactive crud. The chelating agents form multiple bonds, making them very persistent in nature. They are able to keep the dissolved radioactive rust in solution, increasing its mobility in the environment potentially for many decades and beyond. When waste bonded to chelates are buried, they are able to migrate out of the trenches into the groundwater and the uncontrolled environment. Unless the plant's liquid radioactive waste containing chelates are kept isolated from the rest of the waste, the dissolved waste can become a part of the waste stream that is released into the river, lake, or ocean. Since the chelates are non-biodegradable in nature, the crud bonded to the chelates remains dissolved and highly mobile. The buildup of crud at reactors nationwide and the resulting increase in radioactive waste will obviously increase within the older plants for which operating licenses have been extended to a 60-year duration instead of 40 years for which the plants were designed. When I initially began reading about nuclear power, I accepted the claim that the heated pressurized water in a typical reactor circulates in a, quote, closed loop, that is, from the reactor vessel into some 22,000 thin-walled steam generator tubes in order to generate steam to run the turbine generator, and then goes back into the reactor vessel. But I gradually learned that the closed loop is not completely closed. Proponents of the increased use of nuclear power like to say that no air pollutants are released from nuclear reactors. That just is not true. Radioactive wastes are released into the air and water as a part of the routine operation of every nuclear power plant.
That was Kay Dry, former board member of Beyond Nuclear. The next speaker is David Freeman. David Freeman has dealt with nuclear power plants and public utilities all his life. An engineer and lawyer, he was energy advisor to President Jimmy Carter. He held top positions at the New York Power Authority, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, Lower Colorado River Authority, and the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. During his tenure in Sacramento, David Freeman initiated the nation's most intensive utility conservation program, including electric vehicle, wind, and solar programs.
The title of my talk is What the History of Nuclear Power Tells Us About the Future. It tells us to forget it, for God's sakes.
That's my talk. Thank you very much.
I'm not going to let you off that easy. I think the label for the industry's program is trying to make success out of failure. I have never seen a technology fail as miserably as the nuclear option has failed. And the word that comes to my mind is chutzpah. How can they possibly have the nerve to come to the American people after decades of failure? And I'm not talking as a kibitzer or somebody who's been in the academic world writing papers about this. I have been there. I've experienced it. And I will tell you about it. But first of all, the word guilt hasn't been mentioned here. And we have to recognize that this whole atomic energy program, Atoms for Peace and all, was born out of the guilt that the people had in dropping the bomb. Remember, the State Department spread this all over the world. Everybody had their little Atoms for Peace program. I remember when I went to Israel in 73 to talk them out of building a nuclear reactor, they told me, well, Ben Gurion said that a modern state has to have atomic energy. And that was kind of the mindset. I myself, as a young civil engineer working for TVA in 1949, applied for TVA's nuclear program. I wanted to go to Oak Ridge. It was considered the cat's meow. When the first light water reactors were built at Oyster Creek in the late 60s, Milton Shaw, who was in charge of that program, told the AEC that they weren't ready yet. But GE was ready to start selling them, and the NRC overruled him and made a certificate of practicality or whatever it was, and we were off to the races. I had the misfortune of inheriting an armada of 14 nuclear reactors when President Carter named me to head the Tennessee Valley Authority. I'm proud of the fact that on the basis of my vote alone, we shut 8 of them down while they were in midstream. And then I buried one out in Sacramento when I took over the Sacramento Municipal Utility. People that have had experience with nuclear power have acquired a little bit of wisdom on the subject. TVA neglected all of its other power plants and just built nukes one after another. And it would have been broke if I hadn't shut the ones down. There was a historic meeting between me and Senator Howard Baker. The breeder program was getting in trouble in the Congress. And Senator Baker, who was from Tennessee, I was the head of TVA, called me into his office and said, "Dave, I want TVA to take over the breeder program." It was located in Oak Ridge and was in our service area. And in my characteristic way, I said, "Well, Senator, does that mean I'd have to testify in favor of it?" He said, "Dave, I'm serious." I said, "Well, Senator, I'm serious too." I said, "I couldn't testify in favor of it." He just shook his head. And, of course, we didn't take over the breeder program, and it died. So I played a little bit of role in seeing to it that the marketplace and the cost overruns and everything put an end to that failure. The light water reactors failed. Nobody has bought one for over 20 years. The breeder program failed. The whole program has failed. Now they're coming back, and it just boggles my mind. Here we are in an age of terror, and they want to put radioactive Trojan horses into our country. Now, the only benefit we've gotten out of this nuclear revival program is it has brought a number of conservative people into supporting the global warming issue. This increased interest in Washington, I think, is a almost direct result of a bunch of conservative Republican people being lobbied by the nuclear lobby to support the idea that global warming is serious. So I give them credit for that. But that doesn't mean that we have to be stupid enough to go down that nuclear rat hole again. I mean, the arguments, let me just summarize them. They've been said here again, but I think putting them all together is important. The risk of a nuclear accident, everyone agrees, is more than zero. That's too much. Because if you have a major accident, it's going to kill and cause cancer to huge numbers of people. The risk from the day-to-day dosage coming out of the nuclear plants is more than zero. It's unacceptable. There's no threshold. We have the proliferation impact. How can we preach to the rest of the world not to go down this trail if we resurrect it and go down it ourselves? We become extreme hypocrites. It just ties our hands on trying to contain nuclear proliferation. It's definitely not economic. I mean, that's very clear. It's been demonstrated. But there's another factor about the economics. I once had a conversation with Ken Lay about nuclear power. Ken Lay is, of course, the greatest proponent of the marketplace that ever hit this world. And he said he'd never buy one. And I said, "Well, why?" He says, "Because the lead time is 5 or 6 years, and I don't build speculative power plants. I have no idea what the load's going to be 6 years from now. And in an era of deregulation, there's no way a sane capitalist would buy a nuclear power plant." And he's right. It's only in a monopoly situation, in a socialist environment like France, or an extreme monopoly with a lot of subsidy, that you would even think about it. And it takes a police state to live with it. and think about that. Think about that. So, you know, we have a list long enough to choke a horse of reasons not to do it. And then there's another reason. And I can say this as a guy that's run a half a dozen major utilities as a CEO or the chairman of the board. The opposition to nuclear power is a fact. And if you're a CEO and you're contemplating what kind of power plant to build, you will go for a solar plant 10 times in a row before you'll go for a nuclear plant once, because you can't be sure that you can get the sucker built. And democracy is alive and well at the state level, most of this country. So that dog's just not going to hunt. We have to really look at this energy problem, though, and recognize that there's got to be an answer. There's got to be an answer to our dependency on imported oil, and there's got to be an answer to the growing terror of global warming. And we need to recognize that the answer has to be broader than just the electric power field. The electricity is about 20-some-odd percent of the energy business. There is the transportation sector, and then there is the whole heating and industrial use that natural gas supplies. And if we're really going to deal with global warming, we've got to recognize that there's as much carbon going in the air from the transportation sector as there is from the electric power sector. And there is just one answer that I know of that will cure both, and that is to harness the renewable energy resources on this earth. Renewable resources is gigantic compared to the coal or the gas or the oil. And they're delivered here on earth free of charge by Mother Nature. And, you know, talk about chutzpah. That's the fusion program. The idea that we are smart enough to where we're going to duplicate the heat of the sun here on earth, contain it, and make electricity out of it after trying for 55 years and not reaching scientific feasibility. And we won't put a nickel into harnessing the sun that's delivered rather diffusely, I know, but delivered, spread all over the earth pretty much, and delivered free of charge. The solar power and the wind power, supplemented by geothermal and biomass, is super adequate. And the technologies are there to make electricity out of it and to use that electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen and pipe that hydrogen all over. And we can have a hydrogen economy based upon renewable energy. The perfect is the enemy of the good. We have good solutions. We need to implement them as though our lives depended on it. Thank you.
That was David Freeman, recorded in November 2005. He has managed water and power utilities in Tennessee, New York, Colorado, and California. Catch me and hang me, my shiny black
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving.
They'll take your money.